Number 6.
Florida Museum of Natural History houses a collection of 3 million mollusks, the group that includes clams, snails, squids, and octopus. It is the largest collection of mollusks in the Southeast and one of the largest 3 or 4 in the U.S. Information about all our mollusk specimens is publicly available online, and it's the largest single electronically available mollusk database. This important collection and its database are studied by researchers around the world. The collection began in 1914 as an attempt by the museum's first director, Thompson Van Heining, to document Florida's varied animal life. Florida and the Southeast was not that well known at the time. Van Heining collected, studied, and shared his knowledge of southeastern mollusks with friends and colleagues who helped document and describe the many species found in Florida, one of the most biologically diverse states in the country. The curator at Harvard Museum named a large and particularly brightly colored purplish-red form of the giant Atlantic cockle in honor of Van Heining and his work. I'm John Slepsinski, Collection Manager of Invertebrates at Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 17.
Florida's state shell is the horse conch, Triplophusus giganteus. This enormous saltwater snail has a shell that can grow up to 2 feet in length, making it the largest living snail in North America and the second largest snail in the world. Horse conchs capture and smother their prey with their bright orange-red foot. They feed on other snails like lightning whelks and tulip snails, many of which are also large predatory snails. Horse conchs are common in shallow waters from North Carolina to Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. The thick and sturdy shell of this snail was an important commodity and was fashioned into a variety of tools by Native Americans in what is now the southeastern U.S. and Mexico. I'm John Slepsinski, Collection Manager of Invertebrates at Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 40.
When you think of sponges, the first thing that comes to mind is the really squishy animals, or, well, bath objects, really, that you can pick up water with and sort of caress yourself with and so forth. But most sponges, in addition to being squishy, also have little fibers of glass in them, kind of like fiberglass, called spicules, made of silica. And bath sponges luckily don't have that. That's why we can use them the way we do. Now, one group of sponges is unusual in that, in addition to very minute fibers of silica, they lay down a very solid, hard limestone skeleton. And those are the sclerus sponges. And these animals evolved a couple of times, and they have bodies that resemble corals because it's made of solid limestone. These were discovered only a couple of decades ago, and they live deep in reef caves. But they have a very interesting history. Back in the age of the dinosaurs and before that, they were so big and abundant that they formed reefs. Today, however, they survive only inside caves. Another really curious aspect of their body is that they go very, very slowly and live very, very long. So they add only a fraction of a millimeter of limestone a year, and they can live for over 100 years. So people use their skeletons as recorders of past climates by putting cores into them and measuring the changes in elemental isotopes and seeing how ocean chemistry and temperature have changed. So they are basically dipsticks of climate change, in addition to being living fossils. My name is Gustav Pauli. I'm the curator of invertebrates at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 44.
Reefs are dynamic places with a lot of big action and scary stuff happening, outbreaks of crown of thorns being a great example of that. These sea stars that can grow over a foot or foot and a half in diameter, full of spines, you put your hand on them, you get really hurt, devour coral. They can put their stomachs out of their body and digest the coral outside their body and slurp it up. And these animals can eat up entire reefs. When a front of crown of thorns goes through a reef, 95-99% of the coral can die. A few coral species have defenses, but not in and of themselves, but by their symbionts. And a good example of this is the Pocillopora coral shown here. These corals are home to little crabs called guard crabs that live among the branches, and the coral likes them so much that it makes little fat fruits for them that the crabs harvest and eat. Now the crabs, in turn, deter predators that want to eat the coral. So when a crown of thorns crawls up to a Pocillopora coral, the guard crabs will congregate on the end of the coral where the sea star is coming from and start nipping at it and drive it away. As a result, Pocillopora can survive an attack unlike most other corals. My name is Gustav Pauli. I'm the curator of invertebrates at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 45.
Corals are animals in the phylum Cnidaria, a very, very large group of organisms that secrete a limestone skeleton. And it's really a common name. It goes back to the days of the mariners that struck reefs made of corals. Most corals that form reefs belong to a single group of animals called the stony corals. But they are not the only animals that have evolved this ability to secrete a limestone skeleton. That has evolved in a couple of other groups of cnidarians. And one of these is the blue coral. Blue coral live only in the Indo-Pacific, in the tropics of the Indian and Pacific Oceans. And they're unusual in that they are blue in color. They have a blue skeleton. All other corals just about have white skeletons. And also in that they haven't changed in their form for over 60, 70 million years. They were the same looking animals way back in the age of the dinosaurs as they are today. So when we look at them, we think that we are dealing with a single species, an important reef former in these waters. But it turns out that there is multiple species that scientists have mistaken and thought they were one. And this is a very common problem in marine science because marine animals often tell each other apart by smell, not by looks. So they may smell very different to each other, but still look alike. And different species, as a result, can be confused by an observer who's looking for visual differences. My name is Gustav Pauli. I'm the curator of invertebrates at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 46.
These two animals you're looking at are sea urchins, and they don't look like your typical sea urchins. They're incredibly gaudy, colorful animals. And not only that, but they're hardly ever seen by observers. Humans just don't encounter these animals. And the reason is that they live inside the reef. Reefs are like a giant Swiss cheese of condo, a matrix. Imagine the movie The Matrix. There's like this alternate reality inside the reef, full of passages. And many animals live in those passages and never, ever come out. Or maybe they come out only to reproduce, to release their gametes. And these two urchins are members of that community. So most people have never seen them. Because we study this biota, we go into the matrix to chase them down, we have collected them and have a large number of these spectacular animals among our holdings. The strawberry urchin that you see here is probably the most spectacular of the sea urchins, and it lives in the tropical reefs of the Indo-Pacific. The other one is a new species that we discovered in this fauna, and it is being named after a friend of mine who was a professor of biology here at the University of Florida and died untimely from a tragic cause. My name is Gustav Pauli. I'm the curator of invertebrates at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 52.
Although their common name suggests they are crustaceans, horseshoe crabs aren't really crabs at all. Their closest living relatives are actually spiders and scorpions. Horseshoe crabs are often referred to as living fossils because the horseshoe crabs of today look pretty much the same as those that crawled around the ocean floor 480 million years ago. Horseshoe crabs are like nothing else on Earth. Among their many unique traits, their blood contains amebocyte cells, which are similar to the white blood cells of humans. When these amebocyte cells come into contact with bacterial toxins, they release chemicals that envelop the bacteria in an inescapable gel to prevent them from proliferating. The special ability of these amebocytes to detect even the slightest amounts of bacterial toxins is used to test for contaminated medical products. Every batch of injectable drugs, surgical implants, or even tools such as scalpels and needles must pass this limulus amebocyte lysate test. Every year, about 500,000 horseshoe crabs are collected from the bays and estuaries of the mid-Atlantic states to be harvested for their blood. Up to 30% of an individual horseshoe crab's blood is drained at a time, after which the animal is returned to the sea. Estimates of mortality caused by this loss of blood vary, but even if the animal is not directly killed from being bled, their activity level and reproductive potential are hindered until they fully recover. We owe a great debt of gratitude to these ancient and beautiful creatures and should do our best to ensure that they continue to grace the Earth's stage for another half a billion years. My name is Patrick Norby. I am a graduate student at the Florida Museum of Natural History, where I study the population genetics of horseshoe crabs on the Atlantic coast of Florida.
Number 53.
Most snails have many small scraping teeth on a chitinous ribbon, much like the teeth on a file, that can be used to scrape food off of surfaces. One group of predatory snails, the cone snails, paralyze their prey with a single hollow harpoon-shaped tooth filled with venom. Most cone snails feed on worms or other snails, but some lie in wait and harpoon and subdue unsuspecting fish. Cone venom contains hundreds of different compounds called conotoxins that interfere with nerve impulses, causing prey to go limp or to go into rigor with continuously tensed muscles. Some conotoxins take effect quickly but do not last long, while others take effect slowly but last much longer, long enough for a slow-moving snail to swallow their prey. Combinations of conotoxins are specific to cone species and even populations within species and are well-honed for their prey. These compounds, each with specific effects, are being studied as pain blockers, some of which can be 100 times as effective as morphine in relieving pain. Already, several drugs have been developed and are currently used in pain therapy. I'm John Slepsinski, Collection Manager of Invertebrates at Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 56.
The Florida Museum of Natural History is a center of sea cucumber research, and you might wonder why on earth anybody would spend a lot of energy studying these bizarre, weird-looking animals. And there's a couple of reasons. One, they are one of the most valuable marine resources in the tropics. They are eaten, especially in East Asia, and fetch very high prices. And as a result, many countries that are on tropical shores harvest them in large numbers. This has led to huge depletions of their populations and management crises. And of course, a lot of colorful characters are involved in this bêche de mer trade. In addition, their biology is fascinating. These are really bizarre animals. They're echinoderms. Their closest relatives are sea urchins. You don't see much of a sea urchin in these. But think about some of the oddities they do. For example, they can throw out their gut when they're not happy and regenerated. The entire intestine can be pushed out of the animal and left behind, and a new intestine is grown. They breathe through their butt. They have a lung that opens through their anus, and they breathe water in through their anus that dilates and pushes things in there, and fishes live in this lung. Pearlfish will crawl in and out of the sea cucumber's butt to live inside its water lungs. If that was not enough, they have these bizarre tubes that they can expel also through their butt that elongate and become incredibly sticky, white, spaghetti-like threads. And these will stick to anything that touches it, including you. It's a really unpleasant experience to have yourself covered in this and try to pull it off your arm hairs. And of course, if you happen to be a fish, you'll probably get so clogged up that you'll die and suffocate as a result. So they're very well-defended animals and very successful until people started harvesting them for culinary purposes. My name is Gustav Pauli. I'm the curator of invertebrates at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 89.
Ribbon worms, or nemertians, are a group of very unusual worms related to mollusks and annelids. Most ribbon worms live in the ocean, and some can grow to over 100 feet long, but are usually much less than an inch wide. Some species live on land or in fresh water. Unlike annelids, ribbon worms are not segmented. Instead, ribbon worms look a little like living linguine noodles, but are often very beautiful with bright colors or stripes. They can stretch and contract their soft bodies, and they move by gliding over the bottom using slime and tiny hairs called cilia. Despite their soft, delicate appearance, ribbon worms are fearsome predators of annelid worms, clams, crabs, and even fish. Ribbon worms feed using a proboscis, which is kept tucked inside their bodies when not needed. When some species of ribbon worms encounter prey, they push the proboscis out and stab the prey with a barb to inject toxins and digestive juices. Once the animal is immobilized, the ribbon worm swallows its prey whole, and they can eat animals almost as big as they are by stretching their bodies to fit the animal inside. Other ribbon worms have a branched, spaghetti-like proboscis instead of a barb, and secrete toxins onto captured prey. Sometimes, ribbon worms digest their prey outside their bodies and slurp up the soft tissue through their proboscis. Other ribbon worms are scavengers or parasites, and a few are thought to absorb nutrients through their skin. Because of their voracious appetites, ribbon worms can have huge impacts on commercially important clam and crab fisheries. Ribbon worms protect themselves from predators by secreting toxic slime, but some fish, crabs, seabirds, and even other ribbon worms eat them. There are over 1,000 species of nemertians all over the world. I'm Mandy Bemis, and I'm a collections manager in invertebrate zoology. I'm speaking for Jenna Moore, a PhD student in invertebrate zoology.
Number 90.
Chaetopteris is a group of ocean-dwelling annelid worms distantly related to our more familiar earthworms. They don't look very much like earthworms, and that is because they have evolved unusual, special body parts for filter feeding. Chaetopteris make a filtering net out of mucus to capture food. The long arm or wing-like structures secrete and support this net and hold it open inside their tube to capture food particles. Their three fan-like segments in the middle of their bodies function much like pistons and pull water full of nutrients through one end of their tube and over the net to capture delicious plankton and other particles. The water then flows out of the other end of the tube. When they have filled their net full of food, they roll it up using a cup-like structure on their back, and it is moved to the mouth by the cilia, tiny hairs that sweep the ball forward. Once the ball arrives at the mouth, Chaetopteris eats the whole package, mucus and plankton and all, and the process begins again with a new net. Chaetopteris bodies are highly efficient filter-feeding machines. Engineering experiments have shown that maintaining constant flow through a tube requires exactly three pistons, and all 31 species of Chaetopteris living in tubes have exactly three fan or piston-like segments. The ends of their tubes provide homes for sponges, algae, and hydroids, which are colonial relatives of jellyfish and coral. Inside the tubes, you will often find pairs of crabs and tiny scale worms. Chaetopteris worms are an important part of the marine ecosystem all around the world. Their filter feeding helps clean up the water and brings nutrients from the water column down to the sediment for other animals living there. I'm Mandy Bemis, and I'm a collections manager in invertebrate zoology. I'm speaking for Jenna Moore, a PhD student in invertebrate zoology.
Number 91.
When giant seep worms were discovered in the late 1960s, they were unlike any animals researchers had encountered, and they were classified in a new phylum called Vestimentifera. More recently, researchers have discovered that these bizarre worms belong to the phylum Annelida, along with earthworms and their marine relatives. As their common name suggests, they can be very large, reaching up to 10 feet long. Their tangled, curled tubes are found in mud surrounding deep-sea hydrocarbon seeps. There can be over 9,000 individuals in a single square meter, and these dense aggregations of tubes provide a foundational habitat for other organisms. Unlike most annelids, giant seep worms have no mouth or gut and few segments. These worms obtain their nutrients entirely from bacteria living inside their bodies. The worms absorb sulfide through their roots buried in the hydrocarbon-rich sediment, and the bacteria use these sulfides to produce energy for their worm host in a process similar to the way plants obtain their energy from sunlight. Because giant seep worms are so long, they can reach the oxygen-rich waters above the seafloor with the gill structures on their head. Their bright red color and life comes from the hemoglobin in their blood, an oxygen-binding molecule that also gives our blood its red color. These incredible worms are able to live in areas usually inhospitable to animals thanks to their symbiotic partnership with bacteria. Giant seep worms are found all over the world along continental margins where hydrocarbon seeps occur. Cold seeps are stable habitats, and giant seep worms can have very long lifespans, growing to 2 meters long over 170 to 250 years. This exceptionally long lifespan makes this species the longest-lived solitary marine invertebrate known. I'm Mandy Bemis, and I'm a collections manager in invertebrate zoology. I'm speaking for Jenna Moore, a PhD student in invertebrate zoology.
Number 94.
What lobsters? You ever hear of them? Probably not. Have you ever seen them? Probably not, too. And that's because these are another group that are major denizens of the matrix, the inside of the reef, that incredible series of honeycombed cavities that much of reef life and most of reef diversity lives in. These animals live inside dead coral cavities, and some of them come out at night, some of them don't. They are very colorful, as some of these images can show you, and they're also very poorly known. We had a study on an island next to Tahiti, Moorea, where we tried to enumerate all of the different marine invertebrates that lived there. 8 of the 9 species of squat lobsters we collected in this one genus, Galathea, the main genus of squat lobsters, was new. They were described in a paper by a friend of mine who revised this group. Revision is when you take a large group of animals and you clean up the taxonomy, you decide how many species there are and describe the new ones. Well, at the end of that study, he had 144 species in this genus. 92 of those were new, including the 8 from Moorea. So that tells you how little we know about the water planet, especially animals that live inside the reef. My name is Gustav Pauli. I'm the curator of invertebrates at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 95.
Many people are familiar with pill bugs, also known as roly-polies. This little beauty here, whose scientific name is Bathynomus giganteus, is the largest pill bug in the world, and he can be found right here in the deep waters off the Florida coast. Despite the familiar body plan, I've often heard people say that this animal looks like an alien, and people have even gone so far as to say that he looks creepy, but Bathynomus is not without his share of adoring fans. If you find yourself drawn to this charismatic crustacean, you might consider showing your devotion by acquiring some of the Bathynomus-themed swag that is available for people like us, including stuffed animals, phone cases, tea strainers, and even a CD. My name is Mandy Bemis, and I'm a collections manager in invertebrate zoology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 99.
Giant clams are some of the most conspicuous animals in shallow water coral reefs in the Pacific and Indian Oceans, reaching lengths of 4 feet and weights of nearly 500 pounds during their century-long lifespans. They are the largest of all clams. Like most clams, they feed on small particles filtered from the water. But unlike most clams, they also harbor symbiotic zooxanthellae. These small, plant-like organisms use sunlight to make food, which can be shared with the clam host. This symbiotic relationship allows giant clams to achieve remarkable size in the nearly crystal-clear waters of coral reefs where there is very little food to filter. Giant clams gape their shells, showing brightly colored blue, green, and yellow tissue that is often sparkly and iridescent. These bright colors and iridescence are the result of iridocyte cells that filter light, sending beneficial wavelengths deep into the clam's tissues, providing energy for food-producing zooxanthellae, while at the same time reflecting back harmful wavelengths. Giant clams are providing information on how to manipulate light that might be very important for our development of solar power. Unfortunately, over-harvesting of clams for food has reduced population sizes and has led to local extinctions on several Pacific Island groups.
I'm John Slepsinski, Collection Manager of Invertebrates at Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 124.
More than half of all animal extinctions recorded in the past 500 years have been of mollusks, particularly snails and clams. The majority of these extinctions were land snails from Pacific Islands and are the result of habitat loss and the introduction of predators to isolated island groups. One of the most infamous examples of this is the introduction of Florida's rosy wolf snail, a predator of other snails brought from Florida to the Hawaiian Islands to try and control populations of the giant African snail that had been accidentally brought to Hawaii in the 1940s. The giant African snail quickly became an abundant and serious agricultural pest, prompting efforts to control its populations, including the introduction of the rosy wolf snail. Unfortunately, the 2-inch-long predator preferred the small native species to the much larger agricultural pest, and populations of native snails quickly declined, resulting in the loss of more than half of Hawaii's native snails, and leaving most of the rest on the brink of extinction. The wolf snail was later introduced to many other Pacific Islands in similar control efforts. The Hawaiian Islands were home to more than 850 different land snail species, only a little less than the 1,100 snails found in the mainland of the U.S., but in a much smaller area. This episode is probably the single most catastrophic extinction event in modern times.
I'm John Slepsinski, Collection Manager of Invertebrates at Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 134.
Half of all extinctions in the past 500 years have been mollusks, especially freshwater clams and land snails. One of the hardest hit groups are the land snails of the Pacific Islands, especially the Hawaiian Islands. Relatively few colonists reach the isolated Hawaiian Islands. In the relative absence of competitors and predators, these snails proliferated, forming one of the most diverse land snail faunas of the world. Hawaii had about the same number of snail species as all of North America north of Mexico, but in a much smaller area. Each island, and in many cases each mountain range within each island, had its own snail species. The land snail genus Corallia included the largest of all Hawaiian species, some reaching 3 inches in length. They were part of a family of snails that were found only in Hawaii and numbered more than 300 species. Of those, only 15 can still be found alive today, and most of those are in imminent danger of extinction. Members of the genus Corallia lived on the ground in the two oldest of the main Hawaiian islands, the islands of Kauai and Niihau, and the last Corallia species was seen in the middle of the last century. The reasons for its extinction are not well known, but probably included habitat loss and the introduction of predatory species like rats. More recently, the ill-fated introduction of the predatory rosy wolf snail from Florida to control an agricultural pest in Hawaii, the giant African snail, led to the extinction of many of Hawaii's snails. Among those lost were many of the famous singing snails of Oahu in the genus Acatinella.
I'm John Slepsinski, Collection Manager of Invertebrates at Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 142.
These are some of the most spectacular sea urchins in the world. They are huge as you can see them. They have very large spines that are thick. They are made into jewelry. They are abundant on reefs, visually striking when divers and people encounter them, and really well known. There are two species known to science. One was described by the father of all taxonomy, Linnaeus, and the second one was described by the father of invertebrate zoology, Lamarck. And these two species have remained the two species in this genus Heterocentrotus for the past 250 plus years. Well, we started looking at these animals and we were struck by the variation that they showed, and we tested to see if two species were all there was. We used DNA for the purpose, we sequenced many specimens, and lo and behold, the DNA showed that some of these subtle variants that we were observing had a genetic basis. What does that mean? That means that two very similar looking animals were actually different species. They did not interbreed with each other. So as a result, they developed their own DNA fingerprints, so to speak. And we now have a third species of slate pencil urchin to stand besides the two named by Linnaeus and Lamarck. This kind of research, again, just underscores how little we know about the ocean and how genetic techniques, DNA sequencing, is helping us to interpret things that we missed as just visual observers in the past. My name is Gustav Pauli. I'm the curator of invertebrates at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 143.
Sequencing the DNA of organisms often allows you to tell them apart and have led to many discoveries when people thought single species were present in a particular place, but DNA told them there were multiple. You probably have heard of the fact that people now think there are several species of giraffe and things like that. Well, sometimes the opposite happens. These two sea stars you see in front of you here were thought to be two different genera. These are much higher levels in the taxonomic hierarchy than species are. They are so different that people really classify them in different groups. But you never see small ones of the big guy or big ones of the small guy. And if you are really observant, you can look into the small guy and you never find gonads in it, meaning that they're all juveniles. So some people decided that maybe there is something else going on here, and these could be stages in the growth of a single animal. We tested that with DNA and found that they are indeed the same animal, and as a result, these two species now have become one. My name is Gustav Pauli. I'm the curator of invertebrates at the Florida Museum of Natural History.